You're listening to the Mosaic Podcast, brought to you by Jewish Federation of Palm Beach County. Each episode of this podcast will offer you excerpts from the Mosaic TV news magazine, which airs Sunday from January to April in the Palm Beaches. Mosaic explores the most pressing issues facing the Jewish community here at home and around the world. And now, here's your host, Susan Shulman Pertnoy.
Joining us today is the best-selling co-author of Startup Nation. He's a political analyst, an international policy expert, amongst many other things. Dan Senor, welcome to Mosaic.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we get started on Startup Nation and the miracle of the Israeli economy, I want to leverage your knowledge on the international scene. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Ukraine war. Do you think it's going to end soon?
I certainly hope it will. I pray it will. Obviously, there are a few scenarios for how it could end. I have a podcast where I've been spending a lot of time analyzing these different scenarios because I've wanted to get as concrete as possible. So on a recent episode of my podcast, we go through every possible scenario, what we can think of as every possible scenario. One scenario is a no-fly zone, which I think is highly unlikely. Creating a no-fly zone, despite President Zelensky calling for one, would require Western powers, NATO and the U.S., to set up a real air presence over Ukraine and take out the air presence, or parts of the air presence, of Russia over Ukraine, and actually take out anti-aircraft defense capabilities that Russia has that could create problems for Western aircraft that would be enforcing a no-fly zone. So I think implementing a no-fly zone is putting Western forces directly in kinetic conflict potentially with the Russian military and the Russian Air Force that I think, understandably, we in the West are very reticent to do. Another scenario is continuing to provide lots of arms and capabilities to the Ukrainians. I think that will continue. There have been some hiccups recently with these MiGs, but generally speaking, I think there will be more of that. The question is whether or not, I mean, there's obviously the unthinkable, which is some kind of nuclear exchange, which we hope will not happen, which I don't think will happen. The real question is there a ceasefire scenario? Is there a scenario where they can reach some kind of agreement to pull back from the fighting and at least bring some calm and stability for some period of time? I think the contours of that agreement are out there. There's an op-ed, opinion piece that Henry Kissinger wrote back in 2014 during the Russia-Ukraine crisis in 2014. And a lot of the ideas in that Kissinger piece are serving as the basis for frameworks that are being thrown around right now as a possible resolution to the conflict. I think we're a ways from reaching that resolution. I think, but what's interesting is a lot of the elements in that op-ed are being talked about now. And, so I think there will eventually be some kind of ceasefire. It's a matter of when. It's a matter of whether or not Russia believes they need to, Putin believes that he needs to do so much damage inside Ukraine in order to have more leverage at the negotiating table. I think Putin's hope for taking over Ukraine or installing a puppet government in Ukraine or occupying the country for some foreseeable future, I think those scenarios are not likely to happen. And I think the combination of the resistance from the Ukrainian forces, the resistance from the Ukrainian people, and the international response, the economic response, is waking Putin up to the reality that he's not going to be able to take over the country. So now the question is, what kind of damage, I think, from the Russian perspective, what kind of damage they do to the country to increase their negotiating position?
Do you think there are any economic sanctions that we haven't implemented that could also be effective?
Yes, I think we are on the scale, on the dial, of zero being no impact sanctions and 10 being the most, we're at a 7 or 8. I think there are more being contemplated that haven't been implemented.
Do you have any?
I don't want to get into specifics, okay. But I think that it could be ratcheted up even further, and I think it will be.
So Zelensky's being called Churchill in a T-shirt. What's your reaction to how he spoke before Congress?
Okay, very impressive. When I thought about how the Russia-Ukraine crisis would play out, I did not anticipate the role he would play. So I did think Putin was overstating how easily he would be able to reach his ambition for Russia, but I didn't anticipate the role that Zelensky would play in dashing those hopes and ambitions of Putin's, he personally. And what has he done? One, he stayed in Kyiv, which is very important. So when you look at resistance to invading powers around the world, it's very often for leaders to get out of Dodge.
Right.
They just leave. They don't want to be in the flashpoint of the action. And they try to command a resistance from some other location. And Zelensky has chose to stay in the center of the capital with his people, like Churchill did during World War II. You know, the cabinet war rooms, the bunker in
right.
London, I'm sure you visited it, where you see where Churchill said, no, I'm not leaving London. I'm not leaving the capital where my people are under siege. I'm going to be there right there with them. I'm going to command the war from here. So Zelensky's doing the same thing. And I didn't anticipate, A, that he would do that, and B, the morale, the shot in the arm of the morale of not only the military, but the civilian population.
It's amazing.
And so I think in that sense, he's been very impressive. Secondly, I think he has used broadcast technology, tools that are available to us today to communicate with the world, that again, I didn't fully anticipate how important that would be, so that he can speak to the German parliament and the US Congress and the British parliament and the Canadian parliament and the Israeli Knesset and the EU. I mean, he can have just these and high quality presentations. I mean, these are not like, it's not like breaking up on a cell phone.
He's a media expert.
He's a media expert, and the technologies that are available to someone like that today are extraordinary, and he is capitalizing on them. And he's a performer, you know. And I say that in an admirable way. I mean, he's a very talented performer. So I think his personal role in terms of galvanizing the world and in terms of strengthening the steel of his own people has been really, like, history will be studying his role. We just haven't seen something like that in a long time.
Well, we have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about Israel's role and how delicate it is in this situation.
Sounds
we'll
good.
Be right back. Coming up, how diversity in Israel creates a culture of innovation.
Mosaic is brought to you through the dedication of generous corporate sponsors who fuel the work of Jewish Federation of Palm Beach County. We thank American Commercial Realty, Appleby Utifrend Wealth Management, Raymond Motor Cars, Bruce Gendelman Insurance Services, Commodore, Singer, Baseman, and Braun Attorneys, First Republic Bank, Rogers Design Group, and Shapiro Pertnoy Companies.
We're back talking with Dan Senor, and I wanted to ask you about the delicate situation of Israel's part in the Ukraine war, and why haven't they officially come out against Putin?
Well, they have been
Russia.
Very. The Israeli government has been very critical of Russia's aggression, much more so than they get credit for. Israel's detractors, I think, are overstating Israel's neutrality. They're not neutral. Israel's not neutral at all. Israel has also been providing extraordinary resources to deal with the humanitarian crisis on the Ukraine-Polish border. They've set up a field hospital. All sorts of Israeli NGOs, in coordination with the Israeli government, have been deployed, like United Hatzalah, which is an exceptional organization that does exceptional mobile emergency care in Israel, and now they're deploying their talent to help the Ukrainian people and help Ukrainian refugees. So I think Israel is doing a lot. The challenge Israel has is that Russia is effectively, from a security standpoint, a neighbor of Israel. It's on Israel's border, largely a result of the U.S. withdrawal from the region over the last decade and a half, and largely because of our decision to not really enforce a red line, the U.S. government, against Syria, against Assad and its use of chemical weapons, and then the role Russia had not only in helping to resolve, quote-unquote, the Syria chemical weapons crisis, but also allowing Russia to set up a military, literally set up a military base. 2014, 2015, shortly after Russia went into Crimea last time, they set up a military base in Syria, effectively with our blessing. Russia has been a major player, and we've allowed Russia to become a major player in the negotiations over the Iran deal. Russia has considerable military presence in the region, specifically in Syria. Whenever Iran is sending arms or personnel to Hezbollah on Israel's northern border or to Hamas in Gaza, and Israel wants to try to intercept that and head it off, it has to contemplate the impact it could have on Russian forces in the region. Israel does not want to cross a tripwire and suddenly find itself in a military exchange with Russia on its border. So Israel has all these complexities and all these sensitivities to consider. In the basement of the Kiryat, which is the Israeli Pentagon, the equivalent of the Israeli Pentagon in Tel Aviv, right. The Kiryat. In the basement of the Kiryat, there's a direct line between the leadership of the Israeli army and the leadership of the Russian military. There's just incredible coordination to make sure that Israel does not find itself in a kinetic situation with Russia. So given all these sensitivities Israel has, it's still speaking out against Russian aggression. It's still deploying resources to help with the humanitarian crisis, as it should be. Every country should be doing what Israel's doing. But Israel also has to balance that with a growing Russian presence on its border,
right.
That was largely created by a vacuum that was left by the United States.
It's very complex.
Yeah.
We're going to switch gears now.
Okay.
About 13 years ago, you wrote an incredible book. You co-authored it, mm-hmm. called Startup Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And you also said it's the story of Israel's economic miracle. So what's the miracle?
The miracle is, let me describe what the miracle is, and then the how
okay.
Israel got there. So what the miracle is, just to provide some data, Israel attracts more global venture capital in the world today on a per capita basis than any country in the world, right? So, and if venture capital is like the most fungible metric of technological promise, because investors deploy venture capital to get the most jaw-dropping returns, backing the most interesting and world-changing innovative companies. They can choose to do that wherever they want. They don't do it based on nationality. They don't do it based on religiosity. They don't do it based on ideology. They do it based on where they're going to see the returns. And they're doing it in Israel. They're investing more in Israel than anywhere in the world on a per capita basis. So the amount of innovation capital chasing Israeli entrepreneurs is staggering. Israeli companies on NASDAQ. There are more Israeli companies on NASDAQ than companies from any country in the world, except for the U.S. and China, which, as you know, are a little larger than Israel. Israel has the highest density of startups in the world. So all this is going on in a country that is historically been surrounded by enemies, in a state of war since its founding. At the time, through most of its history, no access to natural resources. A tiny speck of a country the size of the state of New Jersey. You know, how did Israel pull this off? Completely shut off from the region in terms of its ability to export. Tiny little population. So we were stunned that on the one hand you had all this data that demonstrated that Israel was an innovation mecca, metaphorically speaking, and it was in the least likely of places.
So that's
the one.
What do you think it is?
It's a combination of factors, and we go through them in our book. And basically, if I had to summarize, almost every single Israeli serves in the military at age 18, 19, 20. So they get a crucible leadership experience at a very young age in terms of what it means to manage projects, manage people, lead projects, lead people, take risks, take intelligent risks. Most 18, 19, and 20-year-olds don't get that kind of experience most parts of the world. Almost every Israeli does. They come out of the military, and then they get gobbled up by these startups because they have this incredibly young, energetic talent for running things, making difficult decisions, not burdened by responsibility, but are comfortable taking big responsibility. Two, if Israel is the startup nation, it's also the immigrant nation.
Right.
Right? Over 70
yes.
nationalities are represented in Israel. And at certain times, you know, two out of every three Israelis are either children of immigrants, children of immigrants, or grandchildren of immigrants. At certain periods of Israel's history, they've absorbed huge percentages of their population. In the 1990s, when the former Soviet Union was collapsing, Israel immigrated and absorbed and assimilated 20% of its population. I mean,
that's remarkable.
Just, it's a fifth of its population. So it's a very dynamic immigration society, and immigration historically has a huge role. High levels of high-skilled immigration have a huge role in the vibrancy of a startup ecosystem. The role of civilian R&D, Israel spends more dedicates more as a percentage of its GDP on civilian research and development than any country in the world. So I can go on and on and on with why, how Israel's pulled this off. And I think the circumstances that have been the rocket fuel for Israel's Startup Nation have only increased and expanded since we wrote the book.
So give us some examples of some tech sectors that are just amazing.
So Israel right now, I mean, almost every sector is Israel is somehow engaged in. There are some sectors that historically were off limits for Israel just because it wasn't an area of expertise and like, you know, kind of consumer direct engagement were businesses that were built around direct engagement with the consumer were not, or with the user were not a big Israeli focus. They were much more sort of back end, sort of deep tech solutions, hardware oriented, some software, some hardware oriented solution, visualization technology. But in the last number of years, even consumer engagement, consumer focused companies like Waze, I'm sure you use Waze,
yes.
So that's an Israeli company. That is the quintessence of consumer engagement. And so since Waze, I think a number of Israeli companies have opened up their horizons to companies that do direct consumer engagement. But the big areas where Israel is flourishing right now are in agriculture tech, improving the quality, the yields in the agriculture industry through technology, through AI, water tech, digital health. And digital health, I think, is going to have a real revolution now, especially coming out of the pandemic.
COVID, yeah.
Right. So digital health is a big area. Visualization technology, anything that involves. So Israel has a unit in the IDF called 9900, which is focused on visualization technology. So you see in a company like Mobileye in Israel, which basically provides the eyes for a car. Most auto manufacturers now use Mobileye's technology in their car that helps the car see what's happening, which is paving the way for a world of semi-autonomous, potentially autonomous driving. Mobileye was purchased by Intel. Now Intel's spinning it off, and it's going to have its own, like a $50 billion, I think, IPO. So visualization technology, digital health, cybersecurity is a big one. So Israel represents today about 20% of the global cybersecurity investment. Think about that for a moment, 20%. Israel represents one-tenth of 1% of the world's population,
right,
and is actually the center of 20% of the global cybersecurity,
doesn't
which is one of the
possible, yeah.
And especially coming out of the pandemic, cybersecurity is going to become an even bigger and bigger space because more and more of our lives are going to be virtual. Clean tech, green tech, all this focus on tech around sustainability. Israel's a leader in that area. So I you know, anything touching artificial intelligence, AI is a booming area in Israel, and it touches so many different sectors. So I think you'd be hard pressed to find the sector of technology right now that isn't touched by Israeli technology.
So the technology is also an entree into diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
What a way to create relationships with countries that they've been doing that in the past hasn't even wanted to acknowledge Israel. I'm going to shift gears for a minute.
Yeah.
And I want to bring Israel here. What lessons can we learn from Israel and create more startups in our area?
Every ecosystem is different. When we wrote Startup Nation, we didn't do it as a prescriptive book. It's not like a seven-step plan for building your innovation ecosystem. We tell the innovation story of Israel, and we say some things you can learn from Israel that are applicable, some things aren't. You pick and choose. I do think there's a lot of exciting things happening in Palm Beach and the South Florida area. The two areas I would suggest all communities around here focus on are one, building a world-class research institution. Israel has 9 world-class research institutions. The Technion, the Weizmann Institute, Ben Gurion University, Tel Aviv University, Hebrew University of Jerusalem, these are all world-class institutions. If you look at the successful tech ecosystems around the world, they're usually anchored around a world-class research institution. So I would say to truly build a dynamic tech economy around here of startups, there needs to either an existing institution needs to be bolstered, or you need to begin working on building one. It takes time. Building one of these institutions takes a long time. So that's the first thing I would focus on. Two, the health of the Israeli community, the health of Israeli society is a big reason for Israel's economic success. It's something we overlooked in our first book. That is, that Israelis strive for individual excellence. It is a real free market economy, and they strive for the excellence of their companies and their startups. And yet, there's a real sense of community, and they have each other's back. And they strike that balance between individual excellence and community building and community maintenance and community nurturing. And so it allows people to take more risks because they feel that they're part of a community that has their back. And that's a big factor. And we're doing more research on that now about why that has been such an important role in Israel's tech economy and what are the factors that made it possible, the health of Israel, not the physical health, but the societal, communal right. health of Israeli society. And thinking about ways to create that kind of community here, I think you have the kernels of it, are very important.
Dan, it was a pleasure to have you on the show, and I can't wait to have you back when you write your next book.
That's a date. I'll be back. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mosaic Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to Mosaic on your favorite streaming platform and to leave us a review. Want more? Visit jewishpb.org/mosaic, where you can access full episodes of the show. To stay connected with the Jewish community of the Palm Beaches, visit jewishpb.org or follow Jewish Federation at facebook.com/jewishpalmbeach.